Welcome, friends, old and new. Good to see some familiar faces that haven't been around for a while. Today is the anniversary of my ordination as a Zen priest. It's been 24 years. I sometimes think of this day as almost like a birthday. It's maybe in a way I in my heart I celebrate it even more than my birthday. It's like a birth. That day was like a birth. I got a new name and I came into the world with no hair at that time. Was wrapped in swaddling clothes. So on such a day, I think of my teacher, Venerable Tenshin Reb Anderson Roshi. So to celebrate my birthday today, I thought I'd tell some stories about him and me and our relationship. Some might have heard some of these before, but I bet not everybody has, so. When I first met him, I'd been practicing Zen for a couple of years on my own, had a daily practice going. This was 30 years ago. And then after a couple years of that and graduating from college, I knocked on the door of Tassajara Zen Mountain Center, because the Zazen I've been practicing so far was, I was really enjoying it. I thought it was such a beneficial practice for my life that I thought, I want to do more of this, and I want to get some more instruction, and I want to just immerse in this life of Zazen. So after some knocks on some other doors that didn't seem like the places to stay, I ended up at Tassajara, and although I will mention one of the doors that I knocked on and did stay for just a few months just before going to Tassajara was Mount Madonna Center. And I just mention it today because yesterday Bob Haridas left his body. And so he in 90 something? 95. So a life well lived. And before I went to Tassajara, in those days, maybe still, if you go for the summer, they want you to stay at the San Francisco City Center first for a week, I think, to acclimatize and make sure you know what you're in for before you get trapped in the mountains. So I went there. It was all new. I was 23. And Tenshin Roshi, who I didn't know at all at the time, who was the abbot of Zen Center, and was giving a class at the city center. So one of the first teachings, maybe the first teaching I heard, happened to be his. He lived at Green Gulch Farm, but the day that he gave class was a day I was there. And I still kind of remember that first class. Again, everything was new. I thought it was all kind of a little bit strange, but I was struck. And I still have all these volumes of old journals and notes from his teachings and lots of you know, Dokusans, whole pages of Dokusans that where I wrote down everything just after it happened. And it's beautiful to look back at those decades later. So, but I just happened to write something after the first time I met him. So apparently he said something like, the forms of Zen are ultimately useless and kind of a little bit silly, just like the forms of mainstream society. How to dress, how to wear one's hair, how to conduct oneself. At first, giving up the mainstream forms and taking up those of Zen is liberating, since it's letting go of old attachments. But soon, the Zen student becomes stuck in the Zen forms, too. One must totally immerse oneself in them at such a time. That's interesting. Instead of like, when you get stuck in them, you should give them up, right? You feel like you're starting to get stuck in them, immerse yourself even more fully in them. This is what faith means in Buddhism. To just do something with no motive or reason other than just to do it. The only difference in these new forms is that they are designed to increase mindfulness and ultimately realize liberation, after which the forms may be abandoned. Though we know the truth before we begin to practice, he said, if we practice diligently and with deep faith for 15 or 20 years, then we will know that the truth really is the truth. Apparently he said that. I'm glad I wrote it down. So, then that, I think it was that first summer in Tassajara, he came down as the abbot. He would always come down in the summer and offer a workshop for the guests. And he was teaching the Mountains and Waters Sutra, which has just been a topic of study here, Dogen's Mountains and Waters Sutra. He was teaching that the mountains and waters of the immediate present are themselves the actualization of the ancient Buddhas, and that water is a kind of purification. We can find a purification in water. And maybe he also talked about purification by mountains. But when talking about purification by water, at some point in the discussion with all these guests at an old yurt at Tassajara, he said, okay, so now let's do it. And so we all got up and started walking down the path toward the creek. And this was in the early spring, maybe May, so the creek was quite cold. And I'm one personally who has a strong resistance to cold water. And I think my teacher, I don't know if he does or not, but I know he's practiced a lot with cold water. For many, many years, he would swim in the San Francisco Bay in the winter. And so we, you know, he had his Samoe robes on and just started walking right into the creek down by the, now the old bathhouse. And this whole workshop of 40 people or so, unless they kind of stealthily snuck away at this time, all followed him with all their clothes on, slowly, slowly, in a beautiful kind of silent mass of people waded into the water. And I thought, oh, we'll go up to our knees or something. But nope. Total submersion, purification by water. And it was a beautiful experience for me. A challenge from this teacher that I barely knew. Still have this image of this whole group of people then walking on the path, just dripping and soaking in all their clothes, with other guests kind of like looking at people as they came out. Like, what's with this group? Yeah. And I think it maybe was the same workshop where another day of the teaching, we had the teaching in the plunge, in the bathhouse. So it was with bathing suits. But I remember Tenshin Roshi was in the middle of the plunge, sitting, giving a whole class for an hour and a half, right? And with people completely filling the tub all around him, and then all these people that couldn't fit in the tub, all like around the outside of the tub, encircling the water. And so after that workshop, I thought, I like this guy. He is... it wasn't what I was expecting. That's what I liked about him. And he was, I thought, very, very, he had a sort of a stern and fierce and very upright kind of presence that was, I think, intimidating to a lot of people, including me. But as I got to know him, I thought that he's just got this beautiful, loving heart. For those who have gotten to know him in the past, maybe 10 years, he's just gotten a lot softer. There just was a kind of intensity and unexpectedness to his teaching and practice in those years. And at some point, I stayed at Tassajara for a couple of years. And pretty quickly I felt like this is my teacher. You know, some, how this kind of thing works is very mysterious. There were other teachers coming through, but I think it's just karmic connections. I had a very strongly devotional heart relationship with him, and it wasn't like that wasn't necessarily being like encouraged or necessarily demonstrated. And maybe there was people who were, I think, really close and devoted to him. But me and some friends would when we were at Green Gulch and he would go teach like in Berkeley, we'd all just carpool over there. We would like not miss a single Dharma talk, right? Just always follow him. Those are beautiful years. And maybe after a couple of years at Tassajara, I went and received the precepts, Jukai ceremony from him at Green Gulch. And I think right after that Jukai, I took a break from Tassajara and I thought, before I get totally immersed in Zen Center here, which I could see was happening, before I can't escape anymore, I should just check out some other Buddha Dharma and also do some traveling. So I went to India and Nepal, and partly to check out Tibetan Buddhism. And I think just like at that time, the karmic connections weren't exactly there. Interestingly, that one of my very dear teachers and dear teacher of Shoho, Choki Nima Rinpoche, who I consider one of my teachers who lives in Nepal, I partly went to Kathmandu to see him give a talk because I'd heard about him. But by the time I got there, I was totally sick, as often happens when traveling in India. And I literally, I couldn't get out of bed to attend this talk. And the friend I was traveling with went, "Oh, it's amazing. He's such a great teacher." Well, it was, I missed that chance. Like, the, you know, it wasn't, it was, the time was not right to meet him at that time. And so I came back to Zen Center feeling like, actually, this is my path, this Zen path, which it still seems to be. So as these next years at Tulsihara unfolded, it's like the more deeply I practiced, I felt like the more deeply I wanted to practice. It kind of feeds on itself. I think we all know this in one way or another. So for my young heart and spirit, that meant practice more and more intensely. And because I kind of felt like the more energy I gave to the practice, the more would come back. I still think it works that way, actually. So there was this one sesshin at the end of one of the practice periods where I just thought, this practice period's about to end. There's this last week of sesshin, and I just want to, like, then we're going to this busy summer. Just want to completely give myself to this. So I just aroused this great determination, and just right after the Oryoki meals, I would just walk around the Zendo and walk back in and just keep sitting during all the breaks, and then stay up late into the night sitting and sitting. And and of course, sesshin is difficult. It was painful, right? And but there's great determination to sit in the midst of all this pain. And then on the fifth day or so, this some kind of release, exquisite kind of opening arose, as does in sesshin occasionally. And and it was still like this body was in total pain, but the mind was just so at rest. And I wanted to go tell my teacher so badly that I didn't want to wait for Dokusan. So on one of the breaks, I saw him on his way to the bathhouse, and the fifth day of sesshin, he was very cool. He was just like a big space. And I said, "Come up, can I talk to you for just a minute? I know it's silent and all, but please." And he's just like, "Of course." And he put his arm around me and "Walk with me." And something like, "What about when there's a taste of a little bit of freedom in the midst of all this total misery and pain?" And he said, well tell me about it." So I tried in a clunky way probably to describe what was happening. And he just asked, "What, can anything touch it?" I thought, that's the weirdest question ever. I thought he was going to, like, either approve my experience or disapprove. But he asked this question, "Can anything touch it? This space that you're in?" And it just kind of like raised this big ball of doubt. Like, what do you mean, can anything touch it? He's like, and maybe I even said, "Well, what do you mean?" He's just, you know, explore that. So I went back to the Zendo for the next couple of days and with that instruction. And I think, looking back now, all these years, I think it's one of the one of the greatest gifts he ever gave me was this simple question, this simple meditation instruction. So after the sesshin, this is what I wrote in one of those old journals. When one tastes some freedom in the midst of total delusion and wonders if it's just a repression of subtle delusion, look directly into it. If one sees that it's true, that nothing touches it, but wonders still if it could be any deeper, look to see if the wondering touches it. Of course, nothing does. So just continue to live, looking to see if this is it, touches it. And then I wrote a poem to give Tenzin Roshi. It says, just to be a human being, nothing more than greed, hate, and delusion, pride, confusion, false views, doubt. This is the greatest joy of this life. Nothing can touch this realm that includes everything. A blue jay squawks like a blue jay in perfect freedom. So I think it was after that practice period, just before Tenzin Roshi left Tassajara, that I was his attendant, the Anja, so I was helping him pack up his things before going, and he just kind of casually mentioned as we were packing, have you ever thought about priest ordination? And I said, no, I actually never did think about it. For myself. And he said, oh, okay. And I think I said to him, but I probably will now. And I hadn't thought about it before. I was a youngster, and all the other priests at Zen Center at that time were probably in their 50s or older. But of course I did think about it more, and then we began a kind of conversation about that ordination over the next few years, I think, of conversation about that. And maybe at some point I had asked, what is a priest, or what would that mean for me to be a priest? I don't remember if I asked it or if he said it, but I remember that he said, if you want to be a priest, you have to be willing to give up everything. You have to be willing to give up everything. He didn't say you have to give up everything, but you have to be willing to give up everything. And that was another one of those turning points that, like, I thought, I don't know about that. It wasn't like, oh, sure, okay. Said, well, okay, I'll look into that. Thank you. I think I looked into it for a while and really worked with it. You know, what does this mean? And as it almost again as a kind of a koan or a meditation practice. And at some point he was down there for a practice period in Tassajara. And I got to the point where I felt in my heart that, like, yes, I do want to do this. It's not maybe even so much that I really need to be a priest, but I want to be willing to give up everything, actually. And so again, in my youthful enthusiasm, I'm like, no time to wait for Dokusan. And I went, like, you know, right while I have this in the moment where I feel like the willingness right now, I want to express it right now. So I just went to his cabin on a day off and kind of barged in and threw myself in a prostration on the floor, and he looked kind of shocked. And what's going on? I think he was, you know, eating his bag of lunch or something. Excuse me? And I just knelt before him and said, I'm willing to give up everything. And he just looked at me and said, okay, or maybe didn't say anything. It was maybe a kind of silent pause. And I said, so now what? And he's like, there's the door, you can just walk out and enjoy your day off. Okay, so I did. I think I was thoroughly embarrassed at that point. So then the day eventually came when, I think after a lot of this conversation, the day came first when he said, okay, if you'd like to start sewing an Okesa robe now, you can do so. And I think that had been several years of this conversation. And even more than the actual ordination day, I remember that day. I think it was again like the day or like the minute before he left Tassajara after a practice period, to kind of like, I'm not going to see you again for a while. It's a feeling, and like, you can start sewing now. And I remember just feeling ecstatic about that. Like, I guess this will be my life, was the feeling. And eventually, 24 years ago, this afternoon, at Green Dragon Temple, there was this priest ordination, and I became Luminous Owl Kokyo. And I know, or at least I imagine, that people think about this priest ordination in so many different ways. There is no one way to think of it, actually. And I think that's good, because it's just it's a human construction. Therefore, it's imagined by humans in all different ways. Both those who aren't priests and those who are priests imagine what a priest is. There's no fixed thing. But at that time, and still today, if I had to say something about it, especially like at San Francisco Zen Center, where most of the people are not priests, we might say, we have this ceremony of, we call, staying home and attaining salvation or liberation. And then leaving home and attaining salvation. Shuke Tokudo and Zaike Tokudo. Zaike is the staying home and Shuke is the leaving home. So how we see these differently, I sometimes think of it as the lay path, which is what this temple is largely based on, is like using the formal practice of Zen, like Zazen and Dharma study and ceremonies and forms of Zen, and using these forms of Zen to take care of our daily life. To benefit or to help, to support our daily life, using the formal practice to support our daily life practice, which is, you know, careers and relationships and family and the life in outside of the monastery. And then the leaving home, I think of as using daily life of, you know, forms and of relationships and family and career and so on to support the formal practice of Zazen and ceremonies and Dharma study. So they both have daily life and formal practice. The lay path more like, and I think this is often how we talk about practice, is people are always asking, how do I apply it to my daily life? I think that is that's the question for the lay path, the perfect question. And then the priest path could be seen as, how can I use my daily life and arrange my daily life to support the formal practice? It's almost like which one we're putting in the center, or which one our life revolves around. And I think it's pretty easy to see how practice, formal practice, can be used to support our daily life. I think we're all understand that, how that makes sense. It's maybe harder to understand, why would you arrange your whole daily life to support this thing of just sitting and understanding the philosophy of Buddhism and this kind of thing? Isn't the whole point of the formal practice to support the daily life? So I think it is, that's almost like a question in itself, another koan. How could that make sense? And so if I had to think of it now, I might say something like, what's more like real? Sometimes we talk about these two truths, these inseparable two truths of reality and appearances. So, and I think most of us, including me, most of the time, think that the realm of daily life is the most real, and the kind of forms of daily practice are something we kind of make up that's a little bit like the appearances realm. The stuff of our daily life, that's what's real, and we use this method to work on this real stuff. But I vow, as a home leaver, to question that. And could it be that the understanding of Dharma and the practice is like the ultimate reality, and the daily life that we want to take care of well in order to support the practice or to be supported by practice is a little bit more like the appearances, or a little bit more like it's kind of illusory in a sense, which doesn't at all mean that we don't wholeheartedly take care of every little detail of it in the most appropriate way, but there's a little different relationship to it. We're taking care of it a little bit more like in a dream, rather than this is the like financial security. This is a big one that I confess. This was my last dokusan with my teacher a week ago. I get to still love to see him when I can, and that was my question. This is what I'm working with these days. Is I still feel like I get caught by this idea of like future security, and I attribute some reality to that. And you know, we usually don't share too many details of dokusan, but I've already started, so I'll just say, I asked him something like, "Do you think it's naive of me to not worry about the future security like that?" And I was thinking he'd probably say, "Yeah, it is kind of naive, and you probably should take care of it." He said, "No, I don't think it's naive." So that's what I'm sitting with these days. I'll leave you with one more story from Tassajara sometime in those old days. one time in the, I was working in the summer in the office, you know, the office where they, the booking for the guest rooms is and the bookstore and so on. So the office is like, it's kind of complicated. Those days, now it's all on a computer. In those days, everything was done in these giant pieces of paper. The whole summer was laid out on paper with all the rooms booked in, and you'd have to like cross things out and tape over them, and just, you'd rearrange the rooms, and guests would come in and ask for their money back if something went wrong, I thought that it was complicated, and after the practice period of just sitting so much, and that I felt like this is ruining my practice to work in the office here. It's so distracting, and it's so conceptual, and it's so it's just, I'm constantly thinking about numbers and stuff, it's hard to get into the body. I liked actually when physical practice, like I asked to work in the dish room for a couple of summers. I'm like, nah, this is where I can really practice Zen. You can be in a good posture and you can wash dishes and you can be in Zazen mind. But the office was like out the window, I felt like, for Zazen mind. And it was Dokusan with Tenshin Roshi in that summer. And I just was complaining about this job, and like it's like ruining my practice. It's like total distraction, and I really feel like I should quit. I should, you know, this shouldn't be happening. And like, and he kept saying, "Yes, oh yeah, that sounds hard." After the end of this long litany of complaining about this office job, I asked him for some advice or something, and he said, well, how great it is that you're doing that so that nobody else has to do it. That was another real turning moment for me. I really started looking at work practice a little differently after that, just from that simple response. So, there's some stories. Yes, Mushin San.
Could you share a story from your time at Norbode?
Norbode was less interaction with Tenshin Roshi, actually, even though Norbode Hermitage is this place down the road from Green Gulch that a few of us started so that we could kind of practice intensively, like Tassajara, practice period style, all year. And the reason it's so close to Green Gulch is so that Tenshin Roshi could be this guiding teacher and come visit us and guide our practice there. But it turns out once we started doing it, he just didn't come that much. And when he'd come, he's like, "You all are doing great, just keep going." Like, well, we're here so that you can come and guide us. He's like, "I don't know if you really need anything right now." So that was kind of a surprise, and it turned into a sort of a different thing than we thought because of that. One time, I wasn't satisfied with my, I was living at Norbode, this was just a few of us. We just do like sesshins all the time and very simple practice. And anyone could come and stay. There was just bring some food if you can, because we would gather our food on alms collecting. But it was very open space, and people would come and they're like, "This is great. It doesn't even cost anything, and we can just come and do sesshin." And they would last like a few days and be like, "This is like, there's nothing going on here. It's just zazen." There weren't any classes or teachings or anything. And it's just too much. Don't you have some, like, couldn't we do some longer work practices or something? Like, there's nothing to do. Just sit. So, anyway, my ordination, my priest ordination, at some point I started hearing about these other traditions, other Zen traditions in China and Korea, and also Thailand and Tibet and so on, where they had all these more precepts, I just thought it would be, I need to, any kind of distraction that I'm getting involved in, I need to kind of rein it in. So I need all the support I can get to kind of simplify my life even more and not let my mind stray into greed, hate, and delusion. So I'm like, I need like several hundred more precepts, please, which is how these traditions are. And there was lots of discussions with different teachers in those other traditions, other Zen traditions, and at some point I was taught Tenzin Roshi was at Noah Boat. I'm thinking of it because it's one of the few times I remember him being there and talking with me, and he said he was kind of giving me may I have your permission to do this, to add this other kind of ordination to my current Zen priest ordination. He said I would not want to stop you from doing that, but I just want to tell you that I deeply feel that it will be a big, big trouble for you in the future if you do this. And at the time, I really didn't want to hear it. I had my way. I wanted to do it my way. And he doesn't even have those precepts, so what's he know? And I will be the reformer of American Zen. This will be trouble for you in the future, was his pithy advice. Again, brilliant teacher, I think. He didn't even say what kind of trouble, right? And anyway, it almost happened. It was like the day of my ordination as a Korean Zen monk, after thousands of prostrations that they do in that tradition, leading up to ordination. And it fell through at the very last minute. And it was just like devastating at the time. But over time, I realized, I'm so glad that I didn't do that. It would have been such trouble for me. It really would have been total trouble. And a teacher has challenged me at different times in ways where I can think of various times when I really didn't agree with him at the time, and then later, months or sometimes years later, I thought, oh, he was just totally right on. Yes.
The one thing I've enjoyed about your style is the amount of study, and I'm just wondering, or my impression of the amount of study. I wonder if you could say anything about how you worked your studies in Zen texts and Zen Buddhism and/or Buddhism with the practice schedules. Where you were at Council Har, were there practice periods where you focused on texts? Were you very self-directed? Mm. How did you work with Reb with that?
Yeah.
That time, especially after ordination or before? I'm just wondering how that really occurred.
Well, one of the reasons that that I did end up with him as my teacher was I was very drawn to the especially classic teachings of Buddhism and of the sutras and the shastras and Indian teachings, as well as all the Chinese and Japanese teachings. And he was too, more than other teachers around. He seemed to be, especially like the Mahayana Indian teachings, he would go really into it and he had just done it on his own while he was abbot and with all these other duties. So it just, he was just enthralled by Dharma, I think. And I picked up on that. And I was reading these old journals, and the first practice period I did at Tassajara, he taught Nagarjuna's verses on the middle way, one chapter, and Vasubandhu's 30 verses, and kind of wove them together. And I was kind of blown away. I mean, all this was totally new to me at the time and pretty overwhelming. But I think that first practice period like opened that door. I thought, this, and I think I'd heard about like Nagarjuna before, and like people say he's the second Buddha. I should really like, I kind of decided pretty early on that I'm not going to read like the kind of modern takes on Dharma as much as go to the sutras and the teachings themselves. And I read Nagarjuna by myself before this and thought, there was something in there, but I thought, it's so dry and so like, why does he talk, why do they say this is the second Buddha? It's like, there's nothing juicy in there. It's so technical. It's just like, it's a total logic philosophy and logical reasonings and very strange and intricate ones that hurt your brain just to try to think about them. But when, after this practice period, I felt like Nagarjuna, the door into Nagarjuna, like open. I was like, I can't believe it. Now I understand why he's the second Buddha. So he opened a lot of these doors for me. And then you're right that there wasn't that much time at Tassajara or Green Gulch to do these things. And people would often complain, there's no study time on the schedule. But there was free time. People did other things. So I just, almost all my free time, that's how I would use it. Because I love to, it didn't feel like an obligation. It felt like a great joy. So, squeeze it in. Yeah. I still think that Zen Center would be great if they did put more time in the schedule so people could have breaks and exercise as well as study. But it probably won't happen because it's such a busy place.
But we had study time.
In practice period, there was an hour study every morning. Yeah, that's beautiful.
Yeah. Nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you could do that. Yeah. And there was always free time. And a great library. Yes.
When you said. Your teacher asked you if you were willing to give up the head. It just harkened back to when I finished high school and two of my friends were becoming nuns. And that phrase, giving up everything, and the romance of that.
Yeah.
You know? and I was toying with it too. I mean, part of it was envy. Part of it was the esteem that was held out for people who were, you know, becoming nuns or priests. But I went off to college. But now I feel like every time I sit, that question is there.
Nice.
Are you willing to give up everything?
It's a great question.
Yeah, and I am. In that I'm inviting anything to arrive.
Yep.
And I don't know where that's going to take me.
Yeah. So on the surface, we can hear a question like that, and it means we can take it as in the kind of material world of appearances. We have to not have any possessions, have much food, have shelter, and all those things that are part of monastic life. But we can hear it as it's not about, especially if this world is kind of like a dream in the first place, it's there aren't really things to give up, but maybe more like the seeing that they're really real, seeing that these dream-like appearances are really real, that's something that we could give up without having to, give away our possessions. Just like in the midst of all this pain, is there a freedom that's not touched by the pain? Similar dynamic.
However, it doesn't mean that with the realization that you would have to act on the realization that came to give up all the possessions. I mean, that's there too. What I'm saying, I don't know whether I'm clear, but with realizations, other ideas, concepts fall away. And at some point, it may be that the invitation to give up all your possessions would arise.
Yeah. Or you just realize that you don't need them anymore or something.
Right.
Or you just realize you don't need them anymore.
Well, yes.
For example.
I and the possessions.
Yeah.
You know, it arises.
Mm-hmm.
Usually.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, eventually they'll all be given up anyway. It's just a matter of when.
One more.
Quick one.
Yes, but it's just the additional aspect of the phrases, am I willing to give up everything?
Yeah.
And that's really how it occurs to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know how I love to talk about the renunciate life.
Yeah.
As a paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
But because that's the other side of the question.
Mm-hmm.
What would you get?
Yeah. Yeah. Everything.
Everything.
Seek and ye shall be given. Well, thanks for letting me tell some stories.
Happy anniversary.
Thank you. Thank you. And I dedicate any merit arising from this gathering tonight to my kind-hearted, venerable teacher, Tenzin Zenki Roshi. May his life be long, his health be robust, and his teaching continue to spread everywhere for the benefit of all beings. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless.